This is the subcommittee of the Local Government of the Future Committee of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. I'm Brendan Sharkey, the chair, and we're joined here with Lyle Ray, who is our vice chair, and other various members and guests. This is a recorded meeting, so please remember that if you're looking to be recognized, to acknowledge by the hand waving signal on your screen, or just visually wave your hand in front of the camera, and remember to unmute yourself. But otherwise, we'll be conducting this meeting virtually. So not on the agenda for today, but critically important for our discussion today is a fact that some of you may already know about, but I just wanted to make sure that we didn't let the meeting go by without acknowledging it. Today's our vice chair's last day of work at the CROC, which is a sad day for, I think, all of us. But obviously we wish him well. So Lyle, I don't know if you have any comments you'd like to make, or
I have extensive prepared remarks. The bottom line is it's 17 years and 5 months, so it's not like I'm a scofflaw in terms of duration. I will be on contract with CROG and working with, we hope, ACR through the end of calendar 21. So it's my last official full-time day, but I'm going to be tracking certain projects and efforts for CROG through the end of the year. So with everyone's acquiescence here, I will continue participating here through the end of December 2021. But thank you all. It's been a great participation in ACIR. And as I say, I expect to continue through the end of December of this year. So thanks.
Great. I should just mention that I yesterday ran into my predecessor as chair of ACIR, Mayor O'Leary from Waterbury, who was aware of your retirement, Lyle, and he asked me to convey to you his appreciation for all your help. And
thank you.
And I won't go on. I think we all can kind of express our appreciation to Lyle individually, but I just think it's this is an extraordinary man who's given an extraordinary talent to the state of Connecticut over the last 20 years or more. My entire history of being involved in the state of Connecticut has always had Lyle Ray attached to it, and he was a tremendous support and guide for me in my roles in the legislature, not only in my more recent years in leadership, but also as chair of the Planning and Development Committee, and before that as a rank and file guy. I had a lot of interest in these issues, and I came to the legislature with a passion for a lot of these issues, and Lyle was kind of a guiding light along for that for many years. So I just want to acknowledge that and express my appreciation to Lyle for everything he's done for me as well as for the state of Connecticut. So
thanks for your kind words. Appreciate it.
Thanks. And we could take up the entire meeting doing tributes.
That's a lot. Yeah.
But he's got to leave in, an hour. So. So this is the second meeting that the subcommittee has held on the subject of, Bruce has correctly put on the agenda a review of the meeting notes from last month. I don't know if anyone has any comments. These are not official minutes per se. So unless anyone has any particular additions or subtractions to those notes that Bruce dutifully put together, we can kind of move on from that. Seeing none. So what we did last month was, and over the last couple of months, as we've formed this study, formed ACIR on home rule and its impacts on how the local government of the future will proceed. We decided to, first of all, create a baseline understanding of what home rule means, what are our statutory and constitutional limits that we place as a state on local governments, and then apply each of those, that knowledge to individual aspects of local governance that we've identified. So on that first step, Attorney Steve Mednick has been good enough to volunteer to provide us with that type of baseline understanding. And we discussed this at our meeting last week, and in the intervening few weeks, Steve has actually put that to paper and has produced a summary of that. And I think before we get into the topic of today's meeting as well, which is the question of finances and local finances and the impact of home rule on that, I thought it was a good idea to have Steve kind of walk us through his findings, which you all should have at this point, again, to kind of form that baseline for us as we then move on to these individual subjects. So hopefully not putting Steve on, I think Steve was prepared for this, so with that, I'll hand off to you, Steve.
Thank you. Yes, unlike last month, I am prepared today, and everybody had a chance to review the document that I sent out in the last few days. Since I have the floor,
Steve, before you take the floor, I didn't mean to imply that you were unprepared last month. I just
I'm directly stating that I was unprepared last month. You know, you're very kind. I think it was a very productive discussion, but I was hoping to have done what I did today last time. So today we do have the statement. And I'll kind of walk you through it if you'd like. It's pretty, I try to keep it as basic as possible. I want to say, first of all, to Lyle, that I've known Lyle for a number of years and take great inspiration with his leadership in the area that we're all concerned about, local government. I spent a lot of time with COG leaders, starting with Peter Dore Palin and Sam and Francis, who are part of this group. Lyle and the Capital Region have been among the great leaders in the state, and I am sorry he's going to be leaving. I'm glad he'll be staying for the rest of the year, and I hope we'll maintain an association wherever he may be for time immemorial on these important subjects. So I just wanted to add to the speaker to Lyle Ray.
Thank you, Steve. Much appreciated. Yep.
My pleasure. So what I basically wanted to try to do, and I wanted to try to keep it as non-legal as possible, that's almost impossible for a lawyer to do, especially with a legal concept. I really wanted to try to lay out some of the confusion of the term home rule. One of the terms I use with my charter revision commissions is I talk about it as being a misnomer, that it's a term that seems self-evident. If you look at it, you think you know what it means, but it means different things to different people. Some people think it is synonymous with local authority or local control, or even the concept of sovereignty, as we'll see in a few moments. It really is not anywhere close to sovereignty. Basically, it's a misnomer that's rife with ambiguity and misunderstanding. And so, you know, why is it that this is the case? And what we're trying to do here is come up with a simple, direct, and readable, understandable definition of home rule. But home rule does have its origins, at least in this country, in a mid-19th century series of rulings by Judge Dillon in the middle of the country in Iowa. It's a maxim known as Dillon's Rule. And under Dillon's Rule, municipal corporations can exercise only those powers that are explicitly granted to them, necessarily or fairly implied or incident to the powers that are expressly granted, and essential to the declared objects and purposes of the municipal corporation, not simply convenient to the corporation, but indispensable to the corporation. Dillon's rule has been validated by the U.S. Supreme Court in the early part of this century. It also, the Supreme Court, in one of the cases validating Dillon's rule, made it very clear that the only sovereign authority in the United States is the authority of the federal government and of the state governments. Those are the only two sovereign authorities. Clearly left out of that category are local governments. We had a constitution through the 19th century and through the mid 20th century, the Constitution of 1818, which was really silent on home rule. There was barely any mention of local government. There was some mention, but nothing significant. But local government concepts, the Dillon's rule concept, all started to evolve in the 19th century as a matter of case law. And in 1957, the next significant event in home rule came with the modification or movement toward the Home Rule Act. Up through 1957, most of our charters, and if you look at some of the older charters in the state of Connecticut, you'll still see special act provisions. When I'm conducting surgery on charters, as I do pretty frequently, I try to be careful with special act provisions. You want to maintain those because they may be unique to your municipality. I'll give you a great example, a recall. I argued the Simons versus Canty case in the 1980s, where we knocked down recall in the state except for the five communities that have special act provisions. So we try to maintain those special acts. The objective of the Home Rule Act was to curtail the special act regimen, to move away from that so that local governments could create their own charter. The creation of the codification of Title VII, where the purposes of local government are laid out, not saying in the most clear way possible, and that leads us to one of the discussions we'll have later, but also to the concept that local government should be able to conduct its affairs subject to those express grants of authority that are codified not only in Title VII, but throughout state law. This legislative framework confirmed the notion that local governments are creations of the state, according to some courts, or creatures of the state, according to other courts, with no inherent legal authority. The Constitution of 1965, which a lot of people refer to because Article 10th is called of Home Rule, basically constitutionalized Dillon's rule in effect. And while it also constitutionalized the efforts in 1957 to move to home rule, it did not eliminate special legislation, which is a good thing in some regards, and it didn't eliminate, and it basically reaffirmed the superior role of the General Assembly in establishing those rules by which we conduct local government. So basically, home rule in Connecticut is an artifice. It's almost like corporate law. It's you create a fiction to create an entity to run your business. We have this artifice called home rule that sounds like something that really isn't. It allows for the orderly operation of local government under the superior constitutional and legislative authority of the state. And it makes it clear that local governments have no inherent authority for self-government because the capacity for that governance is derived entirely from the authority of the state. One of the constant refrains you hear, I was doing a charter revision in Middletown this year, and I went through my normal lecture on express grants of authority, and I told them that's why you cannot do term limits. And at the next meeting, one of the members of the commission, who was a bright person, came to me and said, oh, I found a term limit provision in Wilton. And I said, well, how embarrassed I am by this disclosure. Until I called the first selectman and then the council and found out that, yes, they had it, but they did not have a special act. And then I called the chairman of the Charter Commission that enacted it. And he said, well, Steve, the law was silent and we thought we could do it. That is not the analysis. Silence is not authority. So the question is not whether there's a statutory prohibition that says you can't do it or that they're silent. You need to have explicit statutory authority for the enactment. And I try to make that as clear as I can in this letter. Now, I make a little Mary Shelley joke, because when you read Judge Dillon's comments about home rule, he basically says that, you know, legislatures breathe life into municipalities, the breath of life without which they cannot exist. As it so creates, so it may destroy. In effect, we are the monster of the state, the creature of the state. And Mary Shelley could have put it in, couldn't put it in better terms than Judge Dillon did himself. So again, I tried to also in the summary talk about the different things that local governments do. You know, the express grant of authority goes to structure. In fact, that's where we have the greatest authority, creating a charter, amending a charter. But that's not something we do often. You might apply it also to adopting ordinances, which is something you do on a regular basis. It also talks about functions. I refer to the functions of government. I think there was a really good analysis by the NLC on these subjects some time ago, and that is the day-to-day management of the government. And very often you get to an area that's ambiguous, and a city manager or mayor or first selectman has to make a decision and goes to their legal counsel, and they have to construe what the appropriate authority is. And again, it's either expressly granted, or the one exception is necessarily or fairly implied or incident to that express grant of authority. So it has to have some nexus, some connection. This also applies in the world of the fiscal aspects of government, in terms of our ability to prepare our budgets, the kind of taxes that we can raise on a local level, again, are limited by what the state authorizes local governments to do. Another area of purview is personnel. And as all of you know in this room, that MIRA plays a very big role in the day-to-day operation of local government. Binding arbitration, mediation, all of those things take what look like issues where you have some degree of control and shift that control, or have that control defined again by state law. And so the issue really is kind of a conundrum. You know, you can have local control with limited authority. You can have authority with limited control. So the question that I raise at the end is, how can we reform our laws? Do our laws need reform? If you go the constitutional route, and I didn't get into an analysis of constitutional versus legislative home rule, whether you're better off being a state like Florida where there's constitutional home rule versus legislative home rule. I really don't find a huge a distinction there in terms of the ability of local governments to have the ability to run their operations. We're seeing the dispute in Florida right now between the governor and local governments regarding masks. He's losing the cases. I'm not sure they're based on home rule or not. It would be interesting to look at that. When you get into constitutional reform, it's highly unlikely, I think the speaker would confirm this, of going to a constitutional convention, because it opens up a whole can of worms on other issues that are unrelated to local government. So it really limits us to looking at legislative reform, statutory reform, Title VII reform, or practice reform in the field. Are there things that can be done from a practice perspective that would to modify the way home rule is adopted? So I hope simply to lay out in the 3.5-4 pages. I was a little naive. I could do it in a page. I thought I could do it in a page, but it did not work out. Well, maybe Lyle will make the edits to get us down to a page. But it's but that's what I've laid out in the presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions, because I know we have another speaker this morning. I just wanted to lay it out as clearly.
Yeah, Steve, that's great. And I meant to, before you started, I meant to offer up. I gather I was given the meeting control, so I opened it up in case you wanted.
Well, that's okay. I kind of laid it out and didn't have to. They didn't have the distraction of the PowerPoint.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So here's my question. Can you describe the difference between the different formations of local government, whether they are special act or charter or, and I realize that the same rule generally applies, that nothing may happen without state authority expressly granted, but can you, it's a little bit of a nuance, but it's always one that I kind of struggle with myself, which is, what is the difference between a special act municipality and a, you know, statutory municipality?
Well, Brendan, there really are no special act communities that remain. There are communities that have special act provisions in their charters that they have not touched. I'm working with Hartford, and we have some in Hartford. Waterbury has some special act provisions. They have something called the Water Police, where the city of Waterbury has the authority to put together a police force to police and manage Bantam Lake, of all things. The city of New Britain has the ability to bring eminent domain proceedings in Cromwell, where they have a reservoir that they control. The city of New Britain has the ability to put together a militia to protect the borders with Newington and West Hartford, which they don't utilize very often. And I'm grateful they didn't at the time. My parents used to live on the Newington side of the border, and I was always worried about their safety with that property New Britain had. So you do have these unique, New Haven has kind of a unique zoning authority that has been retained over the years. So a lot of communities are not, look, it's like the situation I described in Wilton, where they didn't even know, or the chair, who was a lawyer, and a very good lawyer at a major law firm, and he shall remain nameless and his firm shall remain nameless, didn't understand the rudiments of home rule. A lot of people have not annotated their charters. One of the things I do when I go into a community is look at charters and try to make sure they're properly annotated, so you don't conduct surgery and take out a unique power if you want to keep it. So there is no distinction. We're all operating under the 1957 Act. Just some communities have retained their special act provisions and others have not.
Got it. Okay. I actually represent a municipality, quote unquote, who happens to be a one of the beach communities in Old Lyme. And, you know, they were created by special act, but you're right. They have their own set of ordinances that have been adopted subject to the special act. So, okay. Thank you. Margaret, you have your
hand. Was Greenwich the fifth one? Special act? Greenwich?
Yeah, Greenwich. Do they still have recall?
I don't know. They're always saying they're a special act community.
Oh, I don't know. They may have. I've never done work in Greenwich. Maybe Francis would know. They're in his cog, but I've never looked at their charter for anything other than budget procedures, and I haven't analyzed it. No, there's a lot of communities that have it. Norwalk has an awful lot of special act provisions in their charter and their annotated. So if towns have been prudent as they've gone through in the post 1957 era, in dealing with their charters, they will have preserved their special acts either in a separate place or not. In Hartford, I'll give you an example. In Hartford, they had 50 pages roughly of special act provisions dealing with pensions. I'm doing my fourth charter for the city of Hartford now. We're finally going to get rid of those 50 pages because we have finally concluded that no one is covered by those pension provisions that were created by special act. But 20 years ago, we were still worried about it. And even 15 years ago, we were still worried about it. We're finally at a point where an analysis was made, and there's no reason to keep those special acts in place and 50 pages of paper in their charter to preserve it. So,
so Steve, if I could follow up on Margaret's question, and it's relevant to the conversations that we're going to have within the subcommittee for the next several months. The language that gets thrown around the state by municipal officials is very much like what Margaret was describing, which is we're a special act community. We don't have to abide by the same principles that maybe you have to in your town, because we're, as the name implies, we're special. What you're saying is there is no other, unless there is an expressly authorized power that the legislature has granted to that municipality on a particular topic or subject, they are otherwise subject to the same rules and same laws as all the rest of us.
That is correct. If they have not touched their special act provisions, their special act provisions remain intact. There are limited things you can do. For example, I have modified special act provisions. I know in Waterbury where they refer to the Court of Common Pleas. And so we updated it to refer to the equivalent judicial body, the Superior Court. So we made those kinds of changes in special acts, which I don't think impact the special acts. But I'm not aware of any community that completely operates under a special act charter that was frozen in time in 1957. I think most of the communities have had charter revisions that have built charters around their special acts. And if they've been smart, they preserve their special acts where they are useful and necessary.
So in 1957, with that constitutional change and subsequently in the 60s, that municipalities were allowed to retain those powers that were expressly granted to them by the legislature. But right. Nevertheless, they still had to create their own charters that reflected the constitutional limitations. And they could retain what they had, but they had to create it.
And most of their charters were probably built around their special act charters, and they've changed over the years. And in some communities, they put those provisions in place. As I mentioned, the five communities that have recall are there because they have special act provisions regarding recall. I don't think there's any town that has special act term limits, to my knowledge.
Right. Okay.
There are five towns with special act recall.
Great. Thanks. And Jim?
Yeah, Steve, we've been talking about charter towns, but there's still a considerable number of towns that don't have charters, probably don't have any special acts. So they're governed by their ordinances and by state statutes. How do they fit into this?
Well, they're governed by Title VII. One of the distinctions, a lot of people trip over this one, but there's an awful lot of provisions in Title VII that tell you how to build a library, a library board, a police commission, a fire commission. Those are the provisions that are there for non-charter towns. So they create their form of government by operating strictly off of Title VII. They're not creating anything else. Be curious to see. I don't represent any of those towns, frankly, so I've not had to deal with that on a day-to-day basis.
Would you say that those towns are operating under a more restrictive form of government?
Well, they're fairly restrictive because you have to operate under the statutory framework for those boards and commissions that are created by Title VII. So, yeah, I think they're fairly restrictive. You come across it recently. In one of my towns, Hamden, we expanded the library board to 9 members. They had originally requested 9 members because they said the statute said we had to have 9 members. And I had to point out to them, as I have many, many times, that statute is not meant for towns with charters. That statute was meant for towns without charters. So under if you have no charter, that's your statute on creating a library board. A charter town has the ability to create it any way they want. So we gave them their 9 members, although the charter failed, so they don't have 9 members. But they would have in spite of that. So yeah, you're right. They're, I think, much more restrictive in the way they operate than charter towns.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Steve. Are there any other questions for Steve? Before we, that's really insightful and helpful. I think it sets the baseline for the conversations we want to continue to have. And hopefully, again, for everyone who's participating, we're, you know, the intention of this exercise is to be able to compile, not only the baseline understanding that Steve's providing us, but the particular applications to real life situations in our municipalities and provide that to the legislature, to the Planning and Development Committee and other interested relevant committees, just so in writing, but also in presentation, so that everyone kind of understands what we mean, because a lot of these questions are, they're coming under scrutiny is probably a nice way to put it, by folks who want to co-opt this notion or misappropriate the notion of home rule for particular interests that they may have. And we need to really, the purpose of this exercise is to help folks understand that when people talk about this stuff, sometimes they don't know really what they're talking about. And we really need to make sure that everybody, it's a little bit of a sticky wicket, because I'm anticipating that when we make this presentation to committees in the legislature, there will be those who will push back, who will argue vociferously that it's not necessarily what we're saying it is. but the law is the law, and the application of the law is really not very ambiguous. Maybe we'll find some examples where it could be, but really what we're trying to do is help people understand what those limitations are. So
can I just conclude that at the end of it, I list out 5 things that I believe this group has talked about. If I got it wrong, fix it. And I'll be part of that fix, but I thought we were addressing the ability to adopt ordinances, roles of boards of education, MIRA, personnel issues, budget and finance, and planning and land use, I think were the 5 case studies we were going to try to look at in this process. And let me just give you one last anecdote, and I will try not to name the town or the senator that's involved in this particular discussion on home rule, but I was recently retained by a town to take a look at the issue of term limits, which they adopted in their charter about 8 years ago. And so I gave an opinion saying that the term limit provision that they adopted was not legal, that it was not authorized under home rule. I ended up getting a letter from one of the representatives in the General Assembly of that particular town to the following effect, where one, he accused me of being anti-term limit and gave an example of a position I took in Middletown, and my anti-position was not that I'm opposed to it, it's just I never thought it was authorized under home rule. That's my position on it. I don't have a view otherwise, or my view is irrelevant otherwise when I'm representing home rule groups. And the senator in the letter said to me, well, we really don't care whether or not it's enforceable. You have an obligation to enforce something that's in your charter. And I wrote a note back to the senators saying that it's just, you know, that's not the application. That's not the rule. You can't enforce something that's not enforceable. And if you want to have that power granted to local governments, get it through the General Assembly. Have the General Assembly create the express grant of authority. And so that particular town actually pushed back on the senator and said, we're going to have a note in our charter reflecting the legal opinion, which was also validated by their local attorney, by their corporation counsel, and put the burden on the legislature to validate that provision by getting an express grant of authority from the General Assembly. But I thought it was interesting that we had somebody who had the authority to create the authority argue that we should enforce something that was not enforceable. So it was, again, that's the conundrum. That's what we face. And the speaker's absolutely right that when we go before the General Assembly, we will probably get pushback on that type of issue.
Yeah, and that anecdote is the rub, isn't it? Where I think a lot of this is all going to roll. It's part of the reason why we're doing this. So with that, let's move. Thank you, Steve. That's really helpful. And I think we'll keep coming back to you and to your reference point throughout the next several months as we put this together. So the topic, one of those express topics that we have identified that we want to look into is the question of municipal finance. We have Michael Lank here with us today, who I've not met before. Mike, welcome. From everything that I've been told, you really kind of know this entire subject from soup to nuts, both wearing several different hats and from several different perspectives. We're kind of hoping to have you kind of give your perspective on it, but then open it up to the group for some conversations and questions that may pop up as we hear a little bit more from you. So with that, I'll hand it off to you and welcome to the group.
Okay. Thank you, Speaker. It's certainly a privilege to be a part of this group. Just in listening in for the past half hour or so, I've learned quite a bit from the standpoint of understanding, home rule and the different interpretations. I do apologize. I'm not exactly sure what the committee was looking for from a comment standpoint. I do wear several hats. I am the current president of the Connecticut GFOA, and also I'm the director of finance here in the city of Waterbury. So to the extent that there's information that the committee is looking for, or if I can be a resource to one of the subcommittees focusing in on municipal finance and the implications of potential thoughts or directives on changing things going forward, again, certainly I'll be happy to assist.
Yeah, I think what we were anticipating was questions that may arise with regard to a local government's ability to either, to do a number of things on the financial side. Obviously, one of them is to raise revenue, and what are the limitations that exist in statute with regard to local revenue sources? And then obviously fines and other sources of revenue. What are the frustrations that you may experience at the local level with regard to the limitations that are imposed on you with regard to municipal finance and your ability to raise revenue?
Yeah, I think as was talked about, a lot of authority is granted through, the statutes, principally the authority to set a mill rate for property taxes. As many of you may know, the majority of revenue for cities and towns is driven off of two primary sources, and that's local property taxes and state aid provided to cities and towns throughout the state. The remaining revenues that are generated, the charges for services and various fees, make up a very small portion of the overall budget. I think, it's been a frequent discussion of if there was an ability to raise other revenues, would that at some point in time reach a level where you could have a beneficial impact on lowering the mill rate at the end of the day for local property taxes? It was commented on, and we share the same experience here in the city of Waterbury in that we are a charter community, and through the charter, we've got ordinances that provide our ability to set fees throughout the budgetary adoption process each year. We do have those fee schedules that are incorporated in our budget document. But again, I guess the relevant point is at the end of the day, those other fees and charges, you know, don't amount to a very significant portion of our overall revenue base here in the city. And I imagine that's pretty much the same throughout the state of Connecticut with cities and towns.
And to what degree do your residents accept that as a limitation that you have? Because I know that in other communities, you know, it's been expressed to this group sometimes that a bit of frustration because residents don't always understand that municipalities are bound by what the state allows them to do. And to the extent that you're not allowed to find other sources of revenue to help keep property taxes down, that can generate a little bit of frustration on the part of residents who are concerned about rising property taxes.
Yeah, it's not significant from the, you know, the comments, if you will, each year through the budget adoption process. The focus, the primary focus remains in on the mill rate itself. You know, the ask of the residents, you know, during public speaking is, you know, just can anything be done to lower the mill rate at the end of the day? You know, we've been fortunate here in Waterbury that we've been able to hold a stable mill rate for several years now. But, you know, we still have very close to the highest mill rate in the state of Connecticut. And it's a very burdensome on this, the residents of Waterbury. And, you know, their plea or their plight, you know, during the annual budget adoption process is again, you know, seeing if there's anything that can be done ultimately to lower the mill rate. But they don't bring up I don't think the level of understanding is completely there from the standpoint of the correlation impact. If we had greater authority to raise other revenues, you know, could we then, you know, have a correlating reduction in the mill rate? And then, you know, I think within that category of other fees and charges, you know, the question then becomes is, well, ultimately, you know, who's that going to impact and what are they going to have to say in relation to something like that? Whether, you know, these fees and charges are revenues generated from non-residents of Waterbury, or is it still an additional burden, be it on the residents of Waterbury or the businesses of Waterbury?
Right. Jim, I'll get you in just a sec. I just wanted to follow up on that. Is there a, and maybe this is also from, not only from your perspective in Waterbury, but also from GFOA's perspective, with regard to revenue sharing among municipalities, I mean, I know that the legislature has adopted a few provisions that would enable revenue sharing among municipalities who choose to associate themselves on this, whether it's a particular development proposal or project like an industrial park that you know, that may benefit the region, or an economic development effort that might be a regional effort as opposed to each town competing with each other and forming a group to share what potential property tax revenue from that development. What's your, if I'm taking my lessons from Steve's initial presentation, that is expressly permitted by statute and therefore can be done. Is that, what's your sense of that with as an alternative revenue source? Is that a model that could work from your perspective or from GFOA's perspective, or are there problems with that that make it impractical?
I think it can work from the standpoint that, you know, particularly if we're not, you know, in direct competition with our neighboring communities, you know, there's good that can come of that where it benefits, you know, multiple municipalities. We do have an arrangement with one of our neighboring towns where there's a development and there's an agreement that has been reached with that neighboring town where as the development comes forward, there will be a sharing arrangement. In this case, it would be ultimately of the property taxes, but both municipalities would benefit from the standpoint that you'd have, you know, in some regards, you know, the equivalent or a small equivalent to a regional development that, you know, is benefiting multiple parties rather than just one city or town. So, you know, under the right circumstances, I think, you know, certainly there's, you know, good opportunities that can come of it. And, you know, what came of this one was the scenario was that the property under development was split between the two communities. And so that kind of drove, you know, the need to, you know, to come to an understanding or an arrangement where we could both benefit. You know, so that drove that situation. But, you know, I think to the extent that, you know, we're not in direct competition and are able to, you know, mutually benefit, that I can only see as a good thing, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah. And to, I'm sorry, Jim, one last question. With regard to what I know Mayor Cronin is discussing in the Hartford area, you know, the notion that it needs, you know, that makes sense, I think, on its face, you know, particularly if a development, a proposed development is straddling the border of two communities, then, you know, figure it out. Figuring out the allocation of property tax revenue makes sense in that context. In the bigger sense, though, of what, say, Mayor Cronin might be considering, which is an actual revenue share among the towns of a region where each are kind of sharing a burden that is benefiting, you know, that may be burdening one community, but disproportionately, but benefiting all of the, many of the communities in the region. Shouldn't there be a means by which we're helping to share that benefit as well as the burden? Within GFOA's perspective, is that viable, practically speaking?
Yeah, I think from the, you know, just looking at it from the municipal finance side of it, you know, it's certainly, you know, viable. Yes. You know, all of these things, you know, I guess just putting the hat on from the accounting reporting standpoint, you know, that can be facilitated, that can be incorporated so that, you know, and I guess I would, you know, direct that from the standpoint of the disclosures that are incorporated in the annual financial statements of municipalities. You know, that type of arrangement, if you will, can be spoken to, you know, to understand or at least to explain to the readers of these financial statements arrangements that are, you know, whether it be a shared benefit or a shared responsibility. You know, I mean, certainly the state has pushed for, you know, on the responsibility side, you know, some regional opportunities. There certainly have been promoting, you know, and supporting, you know, efforts where there may be an opportunity to regionalize some of the shared services really from a cost reduction standpoint, by going the direction of again, regionalizing some of those services. You know, so from my vantage point, you know, there hasn't been a lot of traction made, but again, I think, you know, where it makes sense, where there's an opportunity, you know, I think the counter argument is the concerns over the loss of local control and the implications that may be in play. But, you know, again, I think where there's opportunities, where it makes sense, you know, and it can lower overall costs, you know, for the participating entities on these efforts. Again, you know, from our standpoint, you know, and I'll shift my hat again, I guess, in this case to the municipal side, anything we can do to control and reduce overall costs of services, you know, is paramount.
So you're very much a fan of the bill that the ACIR championed this year and got through, that enables the COGS and REST to house programs that they be done individually by towns, instead housing them at the COGS so that municipalities can actually offload some of that expense onto a regional entity and share that burden. So thank you for that. You didn't realize that you were endorsing that, but thank you for that.
Not fully. I think, you know, it would, you know, certainly it wouldn't be from an offloading perspective. It would just be from an overall reduction in the cost overall.
Right. Fair enough. Jim.
Yes, thank you. So from your Waterbury perspective, could you give us some examples of what would you think perhaps would be options for raising revenue in Waterbury or in the region, which would have the capacity to significantly reduce the property tax? Right away, a sales tax comes to mind, or perhaps a tax on fossil fuels, that sort of thing. But right away, you get into problems with that. A sales tax in Waterbury would generate revenue, a lot of revenue, whereas a sales tax in Goshen, my town, would generate a sort of a minuscule amount of money. So I'm wondering if when you're sitting there in Waterbury, what do you think about when you look to the future and say, well, how should we be doing this in the future? I think many people would agree that the property tax is a problem and that needs to be addressed in some manner. But what are some options from your point of view?
Yeah, I guess just to be honest with you, I don't have an answer to that. I don't know what an option would be to raise enough other revenue that would be significant enough to have an impact on the overall mill rate, a representative material impact on the mill rate. One of the other revenues, if you will, that's been brought up recently in recent years is, you know, from the hotel tax standpoint, where, you know, cities in towns could benefit from an additional hotel tax in the revenue, I believe, would circle back to the municipalities. But again, even in a scenario like that, I don't think you're talking about, you know, enough money that would make a material difference. It certainly helps. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't know what that answer is, you know, from the standpoint of something that would be significant enough.
Yeah. So I would agree. I don't see any significant revenue source that would be fair and equitable across the state that would be based on a local, let's say, ordinance or some sort of a local revenue stream, even if the state granted that authority to municipalities. So we're back to, in my view, the notion that, well, the state becomes the main revenue source, and it's a matter of, you know, how do you share the state revenue in a way that will reduce the property tax in any way?
Okay, thanks, Jim. John, and then Marcia. John, tell us what that was.
Unmute, John.
Yeah, John, you're muted. John, from your hand gestures, it looks as though you're having trouble unmuting yourself. So let me flip over to Marcia, and maybe you can figure that technical.
So my one comment on that, and this has been a kind of a something that we've thought about in many different ways, joining forces with one of the, you know, our neighboring capital city of Hartford, and we think about long term. the discussion in regards to shared development of potentially property that lies within the boundaries of the town of East Hartford. The one sticking point on this would be, we have never been able to, we're talking specifically about a large swath of undeveloped land that is held by a large corporation. And in that, it also sits within an enterprise zone. So how do, when you think about the totality of a shared investment and something that's going to bring revenue to two communities, if we had the potential to build that scenario out with a significant infusion of state and local local abatements, but on the backs of us, but also on a large state infusion of a large significant investment. When you think about that, you have to think about all of the existing protocols that are in place and the barriers to receiving the full value of that property. So I always think that it's great for us to consider working across boundaries for development and generating significant revenue and opportunities for our communities. But at the same time, I'm also thinking that there should be some part of the legislation that recognizes a larger percentage for the host community that takes on those barriers such and the services that go along with them. That's something that we've struggled with. And then, of course, there's the control issue. If it is it quid pro quo, so does that mean that a development in a neighboring city, would we have the benefit of that automatically? This isn't shared boundaries that we're talking about. This is really about working cooperatively and all of us coming to a win-win situation that would benefit our taxpayers. But how do we get to that so that it's a benefit?
Yeah, thanks. I don't know, Mike, did you have any comment on that?
Not really. It's a tough one. I don't know how, you can easily, address all of those type, questions and getting there. It's certainly not easy. If it was, it certainly probably would have been done a long time ago. But Mary LeClerc brought up, just a lot of the type issues that, are prevalent from being able to get there.
Right. John, you're back. So
I am back.
Here you are. And I can hear you.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that. I have a question and I guess another question, maybe a comment. The question I would have would be the difference or what you see as the differences with a community operating off the statutes as opposed to the charter in terms of finances and any advantages, disadvantages, limitations, et cetera. And how that's handled, managed, prepared, et cetera. Sort of the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, I'm not sure the differences. Maybe Attorney Mednick can speak to that. Again, for what I'm familiar with here in Waterbury is essentially the process that's legislated through our charter and the various ordinances, as it relates to the annual adoption of the various fees and charges, in addition to the annual adoption of the mill rate for property taxes.
Okay. And then my other, I guess more my comment than a question is where people were talking about revenue sharing and that and, we have an example up here of four towns sharing revenue on a technology park where there's four investing towns. And presumably as that develops, they'll reap some reward. But I think what that really doesn't go far enough. And when I see the state make investments in with businesses and et cetera, across the state, it's usually community-based and not taking into account, similar to what we do with the two casinos, a larger regional and even state impact where there's direct and indirect impacts, and whether it be education, transportation, other infrastructure, et cetera. And I think that's more where we need to get to. And maybe that's what Mayor Broen is speaking to, is that what happens in one place has a direct impact on its neighbor, in terms of housing, transportation, et cetera. And we really don't have that mindset within the state. We kind of go at, okay, somebody wants to locate in this community and the whole focus is on that community. It's not on what the overflow is to three, four other communities in terms of their schools and other impacts. We have that approach with the casinos, with the slot machine revenues, at least in theory, with the payments that go to the communities most directly impacted and then to other communities, but we don't do that with other economic development. And I think perhaps that it's not what we're talking about today, but just while the subject has come up, I think is something to that should be further explored.
Yep, agreed. Of course, we can. It's a lot easier to form that type of understanding with two sovereign nations that lie within the Connecticut borders than it does to get two semi-sovereign municipalities to agree to the same thing.
So. Well, but you know, I think, not to be argumentative on it, but you know, if the state's holding the cards and it says, okay, we're going to put, I've got a couple of examples here. We're going to put $20 million into a warehouse distribution facility in one town. That's going to now employ 750 to 1,000 employees. That is a lot more impact regionally than it does singularly. And the state, because it's got the paycheck, it's got the checkbook, has the ability to leverage cooperation and to examine those impacts. And part of their calculation really doesn't look at that impact, that it's going to affect the neighboring three, four town school systems or the transit systems from a couple of transit districts. And I think if they're going to be doling out the cash, they should make that analysis and bring those communities together. Often neighboring communities aren't aware that such a deal is being put together by the so-called host community. So I think that's the state's in a position where it needs to take responsibility on that.
Well, that's a great point. And let's use that. Say the Amazon distribution center model, you know.
Yeah.
So are we currently, is the state of Connecticut currently able to enforce that type of cooperation as a state in presenting something to Amazon? Are there limitations that, and this is maybe more a question for Steve, but you know, do current statutes, the state can do whatever it wants to do, right? But the reality is that if the state of Connecticut, as opposed to the city of Hartford, makes a pitch to Amazon to host their distribution center, do we need legislation to enforce the fair distribution of those property taxes to be generated among a region, as opposed to having the towns themselves agree among themselves? Does that make sense? Could the state, as a sovereign, tell, you know, 15 towns in the greater Hartford area, you're going to do this from an economic development perspective. We're going to make this presentation to Amazon to draw a distribution center. We've got a location in East Hartford that we have in mind. Where we want to plant this thing. But East Hartford, no offense, Mayor Leclerc, East Hartford's not going to get all of that revenue from the property taxes. It's going to be distributed out among these impacted towns. Can the state do that now, or would that require some legislative change to enable it? What do you think, Steve?
I think would require some legislative change unless they did it through contract. If they did an agreement between the various communities as opposed to an imposition, I think the state's ability to impose a reallocation to go to a town where a facility is located and somehow allocate their real estate gains or tax gains to other communities, I think they'd have to either do it by agreement or have some kind of legislation that would basically the ability of the community to benefit from the tax revenues. Back in the 80s, when I was an alderman in New Haven, I had been chair of a committee at the National League of Cities on international trade policy. And one of the things I came back with, we never did anything with, I couldn't get Ben DeLito to do anything with it, but I came back with this concept, but it would have been a cooperative concept under interlocal rules of compacts, local compacts, to develop a compact that we'd be willing as a major community haven in the region to put together a trade mission to Italy, to nations in Africa, wherever it made sense. And if business came back into the region as a result of this mission that our community sponsored, because we had the ability as a larger city to put it together, we would agree upon a benefit split. It could be revenues that were raised. It could be job creation compacts. It could be transportation compacts. So I think local governments have that ability. Whether the state can impose a sharing arrangement without some statutory change, I don't know the answer to that definitively.
Yeah, interesting. John, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I think it's more than the state or a larger question than the state imposing. I think it's a question of engagement. When they decide to make an economic investment of a large one, whether it's an Amazon or something like a Rentschler Field or something like that, there are impacts well beyond that host community. But those budding communities or the ones that are impacted are seldom, if ever, part of the conversation going forward. And I've also found that other state agencies sometimes are not aware either. I've aware of at least two major projects out here where OPM found out in one case in a conversation with me casually that the state was making a major, major investment because at that time, DECD, didn't necessarily have to confer with OPM before it made those decisions along with the governor's office at that time. So the lack of coordination across state agencies, the looking at what the impacts of development are beyond the borders of one, I think in the buy-in and those collateral impacts, it's just something Connecticut does not do. And I think it results in dumb growth compared to smart growth and lost opportunities in terms of tax revenues. So, and again, I know this is not what we were talking about today, but I think it's a missing link that we just can't seem to get our arms around that, someone wants to locate in town X, let's all run and do that. Except that it's going to add 20,000 cars to the neighboring town's traffic pattern on a certain road. And now we got to figure that out. 3 years later, we should have figured it out up front, or it's going to add 300 kids to a school system.
Right.
But no, you didn't get any benefit from that because it's all staying within that one town. And that's just stupid.
Yeah.
To use a blunt word.
Yes, Marcia. You have to unmute, Marcia.
I think John raises a good question. And for me, you know, we talk about this large swath of land, but at the same time, there's state statutes that also limit the amount of revenue that this particular organization has to pay. The town of East Hartford carries a very global and wide burden on the impact that the taxpayers carry, because less than 300 of those 7,000 employees live in the town of East Hartford. So they traverse our roads, they impact our economy, but they take that money and they leave and they go back to their respective communities where they put their paychecks into good use. So the burden of a host community sometimes, you know, quid pro quo. We have an incident where, you know, there's been a large number of large logistics centers in a neighboring town that have recently been developed. The amount of traffic of tractor trailer trucks on our local roads has been overwhelming. The quality of life for our residents has been decreased. So these kind of conversations, and I think John makes a good point, is development isn't just locally, it is globally. And there's the impacts of not only for the local residents, but for surrounding communities really need to be taken into consideration, along with state legislation that impacts the host community and carries the burden many times of giving tax abatements. So there's always the reduction of investment in the community. So a global kind of development, I think we all would be better off for it if there was more distribution, proper distribution opportunities that would support the local host, but also the surrounding impact community.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all. Unless there's any other questions for Mike, I think we've reached the end. I know we had another speaker potentially going to be joining us today, but I think he apparently got waylaid. So with that, I am anticipating that we'll have the next subcommittee meeting of this kind with on the subject to be determined yet. But that would be, if I'm not mistaken, that would be the 21st of September. I would also just want to alert the members to a meeting that I think Bruce is going to be sending out some information about later today after this meeting, so as to avoid any confusion. But our first meeting of the study group, if you will, that is now statutorily required to look at how local meetings are being conducted. That's the bill that was passed in the implementation this past year, came through the Planning and Development Committee. If you may remember, the legislation effective next year will require municipalities to offer one or the other or hybrid meetings for local government generally. And we have been tasked in that same legislation to really study that proposal and come back to the legislature with a report by February 1st that looks into the ramifications of this, the technologies, and other aspects of how to actually implement that mandate. So that the first organizational meeting of that study group is happening on Friday morning at 10 a.m. For any of you who are interested in joining, feel free to. And it won't be a very long meeting. It's really just to be just an organizational meeting, but it will be. We will be joined by the Freedom of Information Commission, the Chief Information Officer from the state, as well as the Connecticut Association of Municipal Attorneys, who we need to collaborate with in order to bring that study forward. All right, so just want to give you a heads up about that happening Friday morning, bright and early before a long weekend. Yes, Margaret.
If it's this Friday at 10, I can't be there, but will there be a recording of it that I could catch?
Not sure yet. We're not going to be subjecting ourselves to FOI requirements, so I don't know if we're and it will be on my own Zoom account, so I'll try to remember to record it. I think we actually, as I think about it, I think Bruce and I did discuss that. And,
okay, thank you.
We'll have it available. As I think about it, yeah. So the answer, the quick answer will be yes. It'll be there. Jim?
So as we're discussing this local government of the future, a question that I have would be, what are the goals, the long-range goals that we're looking at? You know, we've talked a little bit about some very important and serious issues that, let's say, the mayor has talked about, that John has talked about. But those issues, in my view, as serious as they are, don't address perhaps where we should be going in terms, for example, the property tax, the relation of the cost of education that the towns bear. There are bigger overarching issues, it seems to me, that from my point of view, the government of the future should be shaped to address these big issues, not that these smaller serious issues shouldn't be addressed, but the big issues should be at the forefront of the discussion, I think. So just a comment.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's the role that ACIR can and should be playing going forward. The purpose of this exercise that the group voted on and approved was to address admittedly a slice of that issue, which is what are towns able to do or not able to do under existing law. I realize that's not the big, you know, big issues of how do we affect property taxes and how do we create more equity within among our communities. Admittedly, also very important issues and ones that hopefully we'll be able to take on in a concrete way. But this particular initiative under the LGF umbrella is with regard to the limitations of current law as they apply to specific examples. I think that's what the group had resolved to do in undertaking this study. If there are other applications, to that particular thing that we can maybe bring in, the group is obviously open to directing us in that way. But I hear what you're saying, Jim, but I'm also not wanting to, try to take a huge bite out of the big global societal issues that I know we are charged to try to look at. I'm kind of feeling the need to kind of keep us in the lane that we said we were going to be discussing as far as local, the ability, legal ability of local government to do certain things or not do certain things. Let's be clear, what prompted some of this discussion was discussion in the last 6 months over zoning and the misperceptions that local towns and residents have had towards their ability to dictate what can and should happen in their communities under local zoning laws, right? And so, there are some big issues that come out of that discussion, but let's start with the baseline, understanding, as a municipality, when you claim to have home rule, that's not exactly what a lot of people think it is in terms of their ability to stop things or allow things. That's kind of the context of this.
Okay, but I understand that, but doesn't it also appear that if we call this the local government of the future, isn't it just like home rule, a misnomer? That because we really aren't talking about local government of the future, what we're talking about is some very specific changes to that would be possible under home rule that would perhaps make life better for our communities, so to speak. So we really aren't talking about where we would like to have our local government of the future vision for the next 20 years or so. We're talking about a much more limited perspective, I think.
I agree. I'm certainly open to suggestions from the group, maybe in the context of the larger full committee meeting, as to how we might direct that and enable that. I'm certainly open to that. I'm only reflecting what I think we've already resolved to take on with our limited staffing and limited abilities. But you know, obviously, if there are other things that we can be looking into, I think that's not only appropriate but necessary. John, I don't know if you had a quick comment on that.
Well, I have a kind of a question going back to the beginning of our meeting for Steve. Is that under Title VII, the towns have the ability to create all sorts of ordinances as it articulates in there. And what I find often, and I'll use land use as an example. All but two towns have enacted the zoning, the option to have zoning authority. And then I'll see a town say, well, you know, we want to exact an ordinance that is very, very close to zoning. It's like, and I guess part of it is, where does other sections of the statute limit Section 7? What are the constraints on the authority granted under Section 7 by other pieces of the statute, if that makes sense?
Oh, it does make sense.
I have one town without zoning, which is a whole nother animal, but I see, you know, towns saying, well, we'll just do an ordinance. I hear that a lot. And, but, you know, they have other authorities or, you know, like zoning, for instance. So I guess that's how does one section kind of limit or not limit, and what are your options?
Yeah. Well, what I stated this morning is Title VII is where the principal powers are in for local governments. Those with charters, they're delineated, and those without charters, they're specifically set forth. But there's also other statutes. Title VIII is where you'd look for zoning to see what the restrictions are and your capacity to adopt zoning, and you have to do it in accordance with that statute. Title 12, I think, are the tax provisions that you'd have to look at those statutes. There's the demis provisions that deal with emergencies. So you can have provisions in your charter to be able to declare an emergency, but you better make sure that those provisions are consistent with the state statutes that give you the authority to engage in emergency activities. It would depend on the subject matter, but it's not restricted to Title VII. That's what makes it so challenging. They're throughout the entire general statutes. You have to look everywhere. When you're engaging in an activity, you need to make sure that you look in the subject matter under the Connecticut General Statutes to make sure that Title VII gives you everything you need, but you better make sure that there's nothing else that the state says with regard to that particular power.
So that, I mean, I'm also mindful of the clock, that's obviously a topic for what I think will be one of the, if not the next, but one of the next subject matter meetings on zoning in particular, and then maybe we can, as we put together our the folks who are going to present on that, we can actually queue up those kinds of questions for that discussion, so that we're ready to go on that, because that's exactly the kind of question that I think we want to get to the bottom of and be able to advise the legislature about as we go into next year. So with that, I don't know if there are any other questions or comments from either the members or the public that may be joining us. If not, I'm inclined to want to adjourn the meeting for today with the expectation that we'll, again, Friday meeting on the study involving local meetings. Our next full ACIR meeting will be the Friday after Labor Day, which is, if I'm not mistaken, that'll be September 10th. We are not going to have one. It's a little bit confusing. Our normal meeting is the first Friday of the month, but because of the long weekend, we push it off a week. Notwithstanding that, we're having our own special meeting for Friday anyway. But and then we'll be back with the subcommittee on September 21st with a topic, one of the topics that we've already identified as the main subject for them. All right. So thanks, everyone, for your participation. Thank you, Mike, for joining us and for giving us your insights. Steve, for joining us with all of your guidance, and for everyone else who's there. And let's continue to talk in the meantime among ourselves about some other ideas that, for example, the kinds of things that Jim is talking about as well. All right. Great. Thanks, guys. Have a great rest of your day.